The Health Minister Andrew Little on the pathway forward for mental health. The minister's due to release a stocktake into mental health spending on how much of the $1.9 billion in the 2019 budget has been spent or allocated. This week he announced a new 10-year plan for mental wellbeing and the establishment of an external oversight group to keep it on track. All this follows the comprehensive inquiry into mental health that resulted in 38 recommendations put to government nearly 3 years ago. The minister himself has expressed frustration with his ministry over the pace of change. But the new long-term pathway for mental being, known as Kia Manawanui, contains no specific measurable milestones. The Mental Health Foundation told us yesterday that it welcomes the initiative, but is concerned it could become a long-term road to nowhere. Andrew Little, Tēnā koe, Minister, welcome.
Tēnā koe, Catherine.
So Sean Robertson yesterday described Kia Manawanui as a high-level aspirational document. How is it actually going to work?
Yeah, I think because as we think about what the long term looks like in terms of how we respond to mental health needs and promote and encourage mental well-being, we've got to understand what it is we want to do. I think Sean's point, as he so often has made to me, is we can keep on funding more and more services as a reaction to the mental health challenges that people can have periodically in their lives or those who've got chronic mental health issues. Or we can actually do something much more fundamental, which was build in mental well-being resilience in our schools, in our workplaces, in our communities, and have it so that people are more literate about what are the drivers of poor mental health, and then seek to change those things. For those people with acute conditions, of course we have to have treatment and services that are responding to that. But in terms of a lot of people who have times in their lives where things aren't going right, it's putting mental distress on them, just having the suitable responses from their workmates, from the communities that they're in, is going to be a much more powerful response than queuing up for the next available clinical psychologist or counsellor. And this sort of sets that out, confirms that this is where we want, this is what we need to achieve. It talks about the short, medium, and long-term sort of steps along that sort of way, but spells out what the ultimate destination looks like so that we know the direction in which we're heading.
So this was welcome. This fact that we're now talking about upstream mental health, preventative measures, promotion, as well as services, undoubtedly welcomed by the Mental Health Foundation. The Mental Health Commission, when we spoke to them and it did an interim stocktake itself, was concerned that there had been cherry-picking, and I think many others would say this as well, there'd been cherry-picking, there'd been bits and pieces done, the so-called fast wins, so beloved of public servants. At least many are saying this pulls together an overall roadmap, but the issue is it is so high-level, it is so non-specific, that you're still without a measurable, plan that says this by this date, please.
Sure, and I think in the last chapter of it says, so what are the next steps? It is now starting to put that detail together. I think when you go back to the He Ara Oranga report, and that was commissioned at a time when we knew that mental health services were in crisis in New Zealand. They had been neglected for the best part of 10 years. Ring-fenced funding had not increased at all, and there were major challenges. And I remember at the time, pretty much every public meeting I did at the time as a politician, the issue of mental health would come up, and all sorts of stories and people telling us that there's some basic things that we just can't get access to. So we commissioned that review. It was done within a year. We got the recommendations. The priority issue, the big gap that report identified, was the access to sort of talk therapies for those with mild to moderate mental health needs. And so we did give priority to that in terms of the $1.9 billion investment package. We did give priority to that. But He Ara Oranga also said, but there's a long-term issue here. We have to fundamentally rethink the way we approach mental health and responses to poor mental health. There's the big stuff like decent housing for everybody, addressing issues around alcohol, poor nutrition, dealing with domestic violence, dealing with impact of poverty, all those sorts of things. Things that governments of every hue, every day have to be thinking about. And then there's what you do with people who present with distress and need those responses. And then, and so they said, work up a pathway that is going to get us to where we wanted to go. We did an interim one at the end of last year because everything had been disrupted by COVID, and we knew that COVID was actually having an impact on a lot of people's mental well-being. And now we've got Kia Manawanui, the long-term pathway that sets the destination, gives us some building blocks to get there, and now sets us on the course of putting the detail around it.
It still feels like 3 years later, little more has happened than confirming what you were told in the 38 recommendations in the first place. At a sort of a high level, yes, we'll get on and do this. You yourself have expressed frustration. $1.9 billion and it's not been spent.
But Catherine, come on.
No,
but that is ridiculous.
That's actually what you said. No, please, let me just elaborate. You actually said those words. You said $1.9 million is allocated, and where is the progress?
Yes.
So you tell me where the progress is over a feasible time frame for actually delivering.
Okay, I can, because I think what Hearanga was also talking about was making sure the building blocks are in place and building it in, not just into the bureaucracy, but into the community as well. So in terms of the bureaucracy, making sure that mental health and wellbeing is a cornerstone of what government thinks about and does. We have the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission. We've established that. We've established the Suicide Prevention Office. That has a program, a reasonably modest program of work to do in terms of suicide prevention, but also postvention and dealing with families bereaved and communities bereaved by suicide. Then we have the Access and Choice Program. So it's a four-year program of rolling out, having people in places in the communities to deal with those people with mild to moderate health conditions. We now have over 570 people, warm bodies, in GP clinics, in community clinics, being available and accessible to people who rock on up to the doctor, who a doctor or nurse practitioner or nurse thinks, actually, this is not just a physical wellbeing issue, there's a mental wellbeing issue here, who can refer them to a health improvement practitioner or a health coach and get immediate attention. 570 of those already around the country, and that program continuing to roll out over the next 2 years as well. So, those things are happening, things are in place. The frustration I expressed about was when we committed 3 years ago to a building program for our acute facilities, because some of them are in a very poor state, and I was just surprised to find that 3 years on, very little had happened in that respect. We now have, that's now being driven. Part of the role of the assurance group that has been set up is to make sure that stays on track and actually happens. But also we know that the next 2 years, because of a range of challenges, including workforce challenges, is going to be difficult to fulfil what we set out to do. But I want to keep the ministry focused on delivering with the help of that assurance group.
You've lost four, I think you've had four heads of mental health within the Ministry of Health just in recent times. You've lost the person who was heading the Suicide Prevention Office as well, a former coroner, after 2 years. What is happening with the leadership? What's happening with this churn?
In the time I've been minister, there was one person who was in an acting capacity, and we now have a person, Phil O'Grady, has now stepped in and is the director of the mental health director within the ministry, and he's picked that up. He's got a good team there. There are some excellent people in that team. I think part of the role of the assurance group also is to provide some support and external kind of reference for the director of that unit as that unit continues to roll out that program. And I think it is timely. Halfway through the program, that we did do a bit of a stock take of execution and implementation, and the conclusion there was that the unit, the people doing the work and negotiating implementation of the various aspects of it, do a great job, but they need a bit of reassurance too, and focus, and that's what we brought to it. And I think when the stock take gets released, you'll see that I think it's a pretty honest appraisal of where things are at, the stuff that's going well and the stuff that needs to be improved.
Can you give us an indication of that now? Because you are with us now just mere minutes before releasing the stock take. What is it going to say? For a start, is it going to look at that overall spend? And I appreciate there's a difference between what can be spent tomorrow and what is allocated for a period of time. But can you give us an indication of progress on the spending and allocation of that sizeable sum?
Yes, so and what I will say is, look, there's two parts to it. There's the stuff that the Ministry of Health is responsible for, which is the $1.1 billion, and then there's the stuff that other government agencies are responsible for, roughly $800 million, and that's MSD, corrections, education has a bit of money. They focused more on the health side of it as opposed to the other agencies, although they do get some comment from those other government agencies about what they have and haven't done. On the health side, it notes the rollout of Access and Choice and says the progress, notes the progress that that is being made, notes the lack of progress on building facilities, notes the challenges around kind of workforce issues as we head into the future, and makes a number of recommendations about how to keep the focus on that, and supports the establishment of the assurance group. So, but I think, look, I think it's couched in just the right terms. There's criticism where it's due. There's positive acknowledgement where that is due as well.
Where there's criticism, rather than just doing the criticising, can we talk about what's the roadblock? What's been the block?
I think the look. So we had the budget in 2019. The work got underway, and we always knew a lot of stuff was going to be ramped up. As you point out, you know, you're spending over a 4 to 5 year period. You expect the first year or so to be kind of getting your building blocks in place. A lot of that was disrupted by COVID. And I don't want COVID to sort of become the sort of uber excuse for everything, but a lot of stuff did get disrupted. So when you're negotiating implementation, for example, of the Access and Choice program and getting those health improvement practitioners and health coaches in place, you're negotiating with different providers, that gets disrupted when you can't meet or it's difficult to meet, you can't conclude agreements and contracts and what have you. So that slowed down. But actually, when you look at where we've got to and got people and positions in place, I'm pretty pleased with the progress of that. I maintain that that there should have been greater focus on getting those building facilities done, because you know, in some situations, the facilities that people have been cared for, people who are mentally unwell have been cared for, and are below par, and we should have given greater priority to that. But I'm satisfied that that is now happening.
Well, where has it got to? Because you called for the stock taper after there was reporting that just $9 million of a $235 million fund for mental health facilities had been allocated. I think you disputed the figure ultimately, but you weren't happy. Where's it got to now?
So that is, because the $9 million was what had been drawn down from the fund, bearing in mind that when DHBs spend capital money, they spend it first and then claim back from the central fund. So that's it. I mean, of the five significant projects, four were in a design and planning stage, one hadn't really got started. That one is now, there's now intense attention on getting that project up and running and going. In terms of the other four, I mean, one was, there'd been a lot of dithering about simply a location on a DHB precinct where the place would go. That's now been decided, and that project, Tairawhiti in Gisborne, that now has a project manager based out of the ministry, because that's the way we're going to drive to get that building done. The others now are, there's been kind of major catch-up, close to concluding the design phase, and construction for most of them will commence, I expect, at some point next year.
Can we talk about workforce? Let's stay with mental health for a moment, because for many years, whether inside the ministry or alongside it, there has been analysis done and provided of the various shortages we have in various parts of the health workforce. Yep. And what progress, if any, has there been on the very great stresses within the system and the shortages in all sorts of specialties?
That has been a major focus of attention, I think, right across the DHBs. And it's why, when it comes to, for example, our immigration settings, there are all sorts of either exemptions or advantages given to pretty much every health discipline you could think. And when you look at, even since our borders have been closed, exemptions from non-New Zealand citizens and residents to cross it to do health work, that constitutes about 43% of those coming into the country, even while our borders are closed. So we have given great priority in terms of getting healthcare workers into New Zealand to fill those gaps. We've still, there are still gaps. And I know for nurses, who have been really under the pump, doing a terrific job in very difficult circumstances. We still have roughly 1,500 nurse vacancies just across our DHB network. Aged care has another 800 odd sort of vacancies. So we still have major challenges. We've put more money into the institutions training nurses and made sure that there are places for nurse graduates to go into in our hospital network. But we still have gaps. So that is a longer term kind of solution or at least problem to fix. But we put more resources into it. We're doing our best working with all sorts of organisations, including the New Zealand Nurses Organisation, to attract, you know, more people out of school into the health professions, and that is an ongoing piece of work.
It's a hard sell at the moment when they read about the stresses that people under and the shortfalls and everything from midwifery through to mental health services. Speaking to psychologists, I think that the figure is, after all the years of training and investment the New Zealand taxpayer puts in, I think many move into private practice within about 3 years of graduation. Do we need to look differently about how we manage a workforce that the New Zealand taxpayer has invested in?
Yeah, I think there's an issue, though, too. I mean, I had a meeting with a psychologist board earlier this year. There's an issue about the number of people, for example, who start clinical psychology training, bearing in mind that you do your undergraduate psychology degree and then you have an election about whether you go into clinical psychology. A lot of people start it, but the proportion who finish it is actually quite small. And we had to talk about, because they raised it, about the credentialing of clinical psychology as a profession and whether there's kind of a mid-level qualification we can look at for people to do. What is the bulk of clinical psychology work, which is, you know, for those who are slightly above the mild to moderate kind of health, mental health issues sort of part of the spectrum. And so, look, that's fertile ground to explore. And it did kind of raise up this issue too about across our health professions generally about whether the credentialing processes we've got for a lot of people who want to go into health are also making it too tough, unnecessarily tough, for people who have a passion for it to get in and to be part of the health system. So those are, and they are, again, probably medium to long-term issues that I think we need to grapple with. I think one of the benefits of Health New Zealand, when it is up and running, it'll be the employer of 80,000 healthcare workers. It will have the heft to be able to engage with the universities, the polytechs, the Tertiary Education Commission, the private training providers, to actually get some coherence and rationality, I think, to a lot of our health training, so as we build the next generation of health professionals.
You've also received criticism about going ahead with this restructuring at the time of a pandemic. And, of course, we're talking about the many demands on a health ministry already, not only managing an immediate crisis, but now undergoing and becoming a fundamental part of a restructuring, as well as the internal restructurings that seem to keep happening there, particularly in the area of mental health. Is there enough bandwidth in government and in its ministries? Is there enough depth on the bench for this at this time, as well as within a stretched health system?
Yes, I'm confident that there is. And actually, it's because of kind of what we're seeing in the pandemic response is an even greater spur to why we need to make the change. And as I've got around and engaged with all sorts of parts of the health sector, clinicians, others who work in the sector, everybody is saying, and it is pretty much universal, everybody is saying we need these changes because we need the mindset change. It was interesting seeing just in the last few weeks as Auckland, that has really borne the brunt of the latest outbreak, as Auckland, you know, so often did with their previous outbreaks, and the pressure that's put the health system under and the reaching out to other regions to provide nurses and other health professionals. One of the clinicians involved in that said to me, he said, look, 2 years ago, it would have been so much tougher to have had those conversations and do that exercise. But because of the direction that we've laid out and the reforms that we're embarked on, and everybody is already starting to think of themselves as part of a national system, not a system of 20 different kind of DHB regions. That's great, and you know, people are ready for this and they want it, and we've got to be very careful about the pressure we do put on people under, and particularly in the ministry, because they've got amazing leaders doing an amazing job in the difficult circumstances that we've got. But I work very closely with them, with the transition unit, and with others, and they're all committed to seeing this in place for 1 July next year. I'm confident that we will get there.
Can we finish by looking again at these workforce issues? Because we are losing nurses to Australia right now. We know that a big constraint or a big limiting factor on reopening is going to be ICU capacity, and you yourself have conceded a big factor in ICU capacity is how hard it is and how long it takes to train nurses. Yet we are still reading today of DHBs and others saying we've got people who've accepted jobs, ICU nurses, who can do like 30 different kinds of specific skill practice that others can't. We've got them hired and we can't get them into the country.
Yeah, I've seen the article about that, and I haven't seen specifics about that. I have heard from DHBs from time to time about their recruitment efforts offshore and making sure that they can bring people over. And I've assisted a couple of DHBs to make sure that they can bring the people who they've recruited offshore into the country. It wasn't too problematic. I'm more intrigued in the article about the health professional who said that, oh, we think it's so urgent, we think it's time to write to the government. They obviously thought it was time to talk to a journalist first. I thought that was an interesting approach to take. But look, this issue about getting health professionals to fill the gaps we've got here is front and centre. And I know DHBs and the ministry are working very hard and working with immigration to make sure we do that. When it comes to ICU nurses, it was because of the experience last year with COVID that we put extra money in for the DHBs to start training up other nurses who, so that they can work in an ICU environment. They might not be fully ICU qualified, but they can work confidently and competently in an ICU environment. So we've trained up another 1,400 odd nurses to be able to do that work. We'll continue to roll that out. But as with so many disciplines in health, yeah, we've got a ways to go to make sure that we're fully staffed up.
Where, by the way, is the nurses' contract at? It's gone quiet. Is that a positive sign or not?
Well, there's two things. There's the renewal of the collective agreement, which has been taking a while. So there's now an offer that was arrived at, or a tentative agreement that was arrived at with the help of a facilitator through the mediation service. That has now gone out to New Zealand Nurses Organisation members to be voted on. The second thing is pay equity, which will really have the most significant impact on nurses' pay. So negotiations on pay equity have now commenced. They started 2 or 3 weeks ago, and that is in train. And we certainly my strong hope that we'll see a tentative agreement on that reached by the end of the year so that we can get that ratified and in place and paid out and money into nurses' pockets and pay rates that truly reflect the level of skill and responsibility that nurses have.
Andrew Little is the Health Minister. Ngā mihi, thank you for your time.